I'm gonna press record now. So what's up? What's good? How are Valentine's?
I feel dead inside.
Why?
We had 150.
Oh my god, the red flower? You had 150? Sorry, I'm just opening up a bag of Kit Kats.
Better. Red velvet.
Yeah.
Target.
We're both really basic in our taste, I suppose.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, should I lean into the iPad?
Oh, we should probably explain that. Sorry, the recording sounds so bad.
I'm gonna try to fix it. It shouldn't sound terrible, but, I put my laptop to charge this morning, and I guess I didn't fully plug it into the wall, so it did not charge. So we're recording this on my school-issued iPad.
Woo!
You might wanna... You like my leg movements?
Yeah.
I'm doing some leg lifts.
Sorry, I was eating a red velvet Kit Kat. It's beautiful. I love it.
Oh, that's really good.
Oh, yeah. Highly recommend. Hashtag not spawned by Target, but I wish.
Not spawned? Target didn't create you?
Nope. I wish it did.
I'm a spawn of Michael's. I went to Michael's today.
I'm a spawn of the fucking Dollar Tree.
Dollar Tree is amazing. You can get some really good shit there. I love Dollar Tree. I love Michael's. I'm a man of simple taste.
Well, I'm glad.
Yeah.
So, would you like to say what we are talking about today? Just kidding. He's eating.
Okay. I'm no longer eating. So, also, fair warning, I have a cold right now. It's pretty much passed, but I'm still coughing and sneezing and sniffling a lot because I'm a disgusting garbage human being who is full of germs. That's really, yeah. It's great. So, we're going to be covering, we're both covering technically two separate things, but they fit together.
They fit together.
Yeah. So we will be covering haunted books / haunted movies. Essentially, that could mean that the manuscript itself of a book is haunted, or what else?
Movies.
Right. Wow. Sorry. Cold medicine really fries my brain. And with the movies, it's like, well, maybe the movie itself caused a curse, or it was the set. Who knows? All we know is that shit's haunted, man. Shit's haunted.
Yep.
Yep. So, I suppose we should begin. It's only, 3 minutes into recording. That's, a lot shorter. We're usually, really
up. We didn't introduce ourselves.
Oh, shit.
I'm Aria.
I'm Alex.
We have a little podcast
called As Long As It's Spooky,
which
you're listening to right now.
Yeah.
Oh, before we actually do get started, I started watching Evil Genius.
Sorry, I've watched it before. I told him he should watch it, and
it is so crazy. She creeps me out. I feel like she would be the type of person. For people who don't know me personally in real life, I work at a small family-run diner. And I feel like if she walked into my diner, she would complain that her eggs were cold when they were fresh off the grill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's the kind of vibe she gives me. But it's less creepy than Abducted in Plain Sight. That shit was crazy. Have you watched that yet?
Yes. It's
how are you gonna... I have so many feelings.
I don't want to talk about it.
It was like, if you guys haven't watched it, it's truly like scarring. If you're sensitive to anything that involves children in any shape or form, just don't watch it.
Please don't.
It's really fucked up. It's like, and it's like queasy, and I was like, I needed to take breaks. Like, I would watch it, and then the mom, it's usually the mom that would trigger me. The mom would say something, and then I would have to go and watch a YouTube video by the kitten lady and watch her, like, rescue little baby kittens until I was ready and prepared enough to go back in. That was a gross sound. I'm sorry.
So let's go to something hopefully less disturbing.
Hopefully. I believe I start off this up.
Yes, you do.
I do. Okay. So don't mind the little clicky sound of my iPad. Because, again, my fucking computer decided to not work. So I'll be covering two movies today. Because a lot of the time, people don't really go in depth about haunted movie sets.
And I'll also be covering two books. So I think, do you want to just go back and forth?
Yeah, back and forth. And if, here, let me.
So that way you don't get sick of one of us talking. AKA
You don't get sick of my nasally voice.
Or my post-Valentine's voice.
Oh, I heard you guys in the hallway. You guys sounded good.
Aw, thanks.
If you're wondering what the hell Valentine's is, it's essentially, Aria's in our school's chamber choir, which is like the most elite choir of how many people? Hold up, fingers. You have food in your mouth. 10 people this year. No.
Hmm.
16? That's a lot.
No, 14.
14 people, which is a lot more than usual. And every Valentine's Day, or like near Valentine's Day, they go around the school and they sing to people love songs that other people paid for, or they call you.
Yep. We had 150 of them.
It's a good time. It's both embarrassing and really entertaining.
I used to be embarrassed. I don't care anymore. I just barge into classes like, hello, it's me.
Oh, no, I'm saying as the person who's been sung to and watched others been sing to. Okay, so let's actually start now that we're...
Oh, God, I know this one. Okay.
Yeah, okay, keep your filthy mouth shut. I love you. I'm sorry. Forgive me. I'm sorry.
Oh, my arm is tender.
Oh, right, I'm sorry. I forgot you got the HPV shot.
He's dying. Give it a moment.
I'm good.
It's not October.
It is not October. It is February.
But I'm still getting in the spooky mood.
I'm always in the spooky mood. Another thing that's off topic, but my friend brought up today that, first of all, J.K. Rowling naming the Ilvermorny houses after Native American creatures is incredibly stupid because she doesn't know shit, clearly, by the way that she wrote Ilvermorny. I have a lot of issues with it, especially as an indigenous person. But then my person is like, she should have, if she wanted to do houses in America, clearly named them Jersey Devil, Mothman, Bigfoot, and Fresno Nightcrawler. And I was like, you're right. We have so many cryptids.
Yeah, but that's not the same as being saying, oh, I'm a Slytherin or I'm a Hufflepuff, like, sounds cool. But then saying, like, oh, I'm a Wolfman. I'm Bigfoot.
I would love to call myself a fucking Jersey Devil or a goddamn Mothman. I'm sorry. I don't want to call myself a Puckwudgie, a literal creature that brings chaos.
That's what you are.
I'm a Puckwudgie in my soul?
Yes.
No, I'm a gremlin in that, if anything.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to go absolutely feral one day and you guys will just...
I should get started before we go even more off topic.
I'm so sorry. Okay. So the first movie I will be covering is Poltergeist. And this is actually a pretty infamous or famous curse or haunted movie set deal, because of course Poltergeist is one of those movies that is a classic horror movie. I love that scene. I watched it when I was like, fuck, maybe 11, because as we know, my mom did not know how to introduced me at a right age to terrifying things. but I watched it, and even today I still watch it. I'm like, this is a fucking good movie. It's just really well written, and it's really fun, and it's entertaining, and there's a happy ending. So what more do you want? Mm. I ignore the sequels.
Okay.
Just letting you know. I would rather.
So tell me about its curse.
Okay. So, as by the way, the original Poltergeist was directed by Toby.
By Tobe.
His name's spelled Tobe, but I'm sure it's meant to be pronounced as Toby. Mm-hmm. Toby Hooper, and it was produced by Spielberg, which is why it has amazing graphics even today. And for people who are completely unfamiliar with the plot, it focuses on the Freelings, who are a middle-class family led by a youthful, dashing Craig T. Nelson. That's how the article
I know.
I got this information from, it describes him. Their life is upturned when a number of paranormal and vicious events occur in their California home, and their daughter, Carol Ann, is abducted through her bedroom closet by a group of ghosts who are under the control of a monster demon called the Beast. So their house essentially sits atop of a Native American burial ground, which, like, what in this country does not? And they spend their free time trying to save their daughter, stay sane, and all the time they're getting terrorized, smacked around, and goobered on in the bathtub. So I'm going to start off with the cast deaths. So the whole idea behind Poltergeist being haunted is not necessarily that there were ghosts during the production, but the fact that it was cursed. And whatever happened, like what they did during the movie, was bad enough to leave for the actors and the crew to just be like riddled with tragedy for the rest of their life. So the majority of the fuel for the curse stems from the deaths of multiple cast members. In total, 4 cast members died during and soon after the filming of the series. 2 of these deaths were highly unexpected and puzzling, leading many fans to speculate on the trilogy's eerie implications. Carol Ann Freeling, the young focal point of the series, was played by Heather O'Rourke. Only 6 years old when the first Poltergeist film was released, she captivated audiences with her stark blonde hair, doll-like appearance, and big, inquisitive eyes. Sadly, however, she was misdiagnosed with Crohn's disease in 1987, and in the following year, she fell ill again, and her symptoms were casually attributed to the flu. A day later, she collapsed and suffered a cardiac arrest, and she was so young, so heart attacks.
Yeah, that's not likely.
Mm-hmm. After being airlifted to a children's hospital in San Diego, O'Rourke died during an operation to correct a bowel obstruction, and it was later believed that she had been suffering from a congenital intestinal abnormality. She's, of course, very missed by fans and has always been. So
that's crazy.
Yeah. It happened, like, for a young girl to just, first of all, get a heart attack. Granted, she had health issues, mm-hmm. but still heart attacks aren't common.
And the fact that, like, they're saying that she, died during an operation to correct bowel obstruction. Like, where
do you go wrong in bowel obstruction? Like, did they rupture her spleen?
I don't know. Like, I don't know how person. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Medical stuff freaks me out. So there was also Dominic Dune, and here's the weird thing to me. Both of the daughters, both of the actresses who played the daughters in the movies, died.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like, it's really weird. Like, why only the 2 daughters?
Yeah.
Like, even the son who was actually being asphyxiated on set at one point with the clown doll.
Yeah.
Because you know that scene where the clown doll wraps around his. Yeah, he was actually choking during that scene. As far as I know, he's still perfectly fine. And I'm not saying, of course, that they should. Like, everyone else in the family should be stricken down by death. But it's just, it's weird. I don't know. It's weird. Yeah, it's weird. So, Dominic Dune, she played the older sister, Dana. And she also met an a tragic and completely out of the blue fate. In 1982, she separated from her partner, John Sweeney. In November of that year, he showed up at Dune's house pleading for her to take him back. And when she refused, he choked her to death.
Sweeney Todd?
Well, he choked her until she was unconscious and left her to die in her driveway. So he was sentenced to 6.5 years in prison, but he was released after 3 years and 7 months because, you know, our justice system's fucked up and doesn't actually do its goddamn job most of the time. So two other cast members also passed away. They were not as unpredictable or mysterious, but they were also very tragic. So the evil preacher Kane from Poltergeist 2 was played by Julianne Beck, and in 1983, Beck had been diagnosed with stomach cancer, which took his life soon after he finished work on the second installment of the series. And the same film was met with further tragedy after Will Sampson, who played Taylor... I just spit on my iPad, I'm sorry. Who played Taylor, the Native American shaman, died after undergoing heart-lung transplant, which had a very slim survival rate to begin with.
I was going
to
say that does not sound like a thing that is very easy to survive.
Sorry, my mom texted me. She's texting me about cake. It's very important.
That's very important. Please, no.
Cake with THC. So, past the very unfortunate deaths, the deaths weren't the only agents of the curse, like, being spread around, since there were other peculiar and creepy legends that surrounded the film franchise and still do. So Jo Beth Williams, who played the mom, Diane Freeling, in the first two films, claimed that director Steven Spielberg insisted on using actual human skeletons as props in an attempt to save money, because at the time, real skeletons were cheaper than plastic skeletons, because we have no respect for the dead. Williams' claim was never verified, but it persists to this day. And for those who want to know where skeletons are used, there's literally a scene where she's, like, in a flooded area, and there are just skeletons popping out of the water. And she's claiming that those skeletons that were in with her in the water were real, which is fucking terrifying to think about.
Mm-hmm.
So, another curse in real life, curse in quotation marks, mm-hmm. of course, that further creeped out everyone involved. Will Sampson, the real-life medicine man who passed away due to circumstances mentioned before, actually performed an exorcism after shooting one night. So he just, you know, performs an exorcism on the set, which no doubt made them feel even more undisturbed or cursed, because it's like, well, if there's an exorcism going on, then what the fuck was happening that caused an exorcism? Yeah. Fun times. So that was Poltergeist. Very well known. And like I said, not very in depth. Excuse you.
So.
Fuck off.
I'm going to talk about a book that is supposedly cursed.
I can't read, so I don't have to worry about that.
This book was actually from Spain. About an orphan that was lost. This book was lost for 400 years. It had never been published. It finally got published this year. So.
I want to read it.
So this book is called An Orphan's Tale.
But I have the reading comprehension in Spanish of a third grader. Sorry.
I also apologize in advance because they do have some Spanish words, and I, in general, am really bad at regular, good old, traditional Spanish.
I can try.
But then Spain just fricks everything up, and I know. It's like, hi.
Spain is like, oh, we're fancy. We're going to use vosotros.
And it's like, no.
It's like, fuck you. Be like the rest of us peasants and just use nosotros.
Okay, so a book chronicling the adventures of a guard...
you want to try it again?
A granda, or a grandada?
of a Granada orphan.
Granada, thank you. Granada orphan during Spain's golden age has been published for the first time. Historia de Huifreno? Freno? Okay, whatever. The orphan story. I'm not going to have you correct me. Okay. Was written by a priest, and it follows a 14-year-old who leaves Granada, or whatever, for the Americas to find his fortune. Its protagonist travels around the Spanish Empire, seeing everything from high society parties of Lima to the mythic mines of Pistoia. He also sees Sir Francis Drake's assault on Puerto Rico.
And fuck him.
And the sacking of Cadiz. Cadiz? Yes. Cadiz?
Yeah.
Okay. And eventually he comes to embrace the monastic life in Peru. So, the story itself is not creepy. It's an adventure of this guy exploring Spain. He's an orphan and, like, seeing all this stuff that happens.
Kind of like The Heart of Darkness?
Sort of.
Except it's not... Well, it probably is racist, but, like...
Yeah.
He knows probably how to use paragraph breaks.
So this is a review by Belinda Palacicos, a Peruvian academic who spent 2 years editing the book back to life. She said, there is an awful lot of traveling, but you do get a sense of what the viceroyalty of Peru was like from the inside of the exchange of people and the goods between Europe and America. So the story was written between 1608 and 1615 by Martin de Leon y
Oh, those Carnes. Were the days.
Jeez. Jesus. Okay. But we're going to just say Martin. and Augustinian Friar. There we go.
Yeah.
Born near Malaga in 1584, who had traveled to Lima. It was supposed to be printed in 1621. But, obviously, that never happened. It never made it to the printing press. Probably because this author was worried it could upset his career and that it would see him to become an archbishop and president and captain general of the viceroyalty of this Sicily. So, a lot of controversy. It would be hundreds of years later that the Spanish academic rediscovered the manuscript from the archives of the Hispanic Society of America in 1965. Many attempts to publish the orphan story had failed, giving rise to the rumors that something malevolent lurked among its 328 pages. When I started working on it, a lot of people told me that the book was cursed and that people who start working on it die. I laughed it off, but I was a bit apprehensive at the time. It had taken a while because the people who had worked on it have died. One from a strange disease, one in a car accident, and another from something else.
I almost got into a car accident today.
Oh, Jesus. So that was a quote from Palacios, who finally published it. So the curse has hopefully been lifted after it was recently published by the Jose Antonio de Castro Foundation, which is dedicated to protecting Spain's literary heritage. So the story itself isn't really too much, but it's the fact that no one really talks that much about the people who previously tried to publish it. So there were multiple attempts to publish this book. Multiple. And like she said, every single person who tried to publish it mysteriously died while working on it.
Aren't there pages missing from it too?
Mm-hmm. So it's like one of those...
Maybe that's why she didn't die.
In general, like...
Because those pages were missing and she didn't read them.
Maybe. Maybe.
Let me be spooky.
Sure. But the fact that all of the, like, all of the deaths happened for, like, just, like, something like a car accident or illness that's suddenly stroke. Or one of them, like, no one even knows what happened to the person. They just kind of disappeared. And they're like, okay.
It'd be like that.
And so now it's published. I don't know if it is cursed to read.
I'll read it and then I'll tell you.
I mean,
if I die, I'll like contact you.
Old book. Like, that's the actual.
That's so old.
It's a very, very old book. I mean, they have some pictures from it.
Yay.
Yay. But, like, that's literally all I can find on it. There's nothing else about the people who previously tried to publish it. Like,
that's not suspicious at all.
I know.
Not at all. I'm not concerned about that.
So, that was my first book. The Orphan Story. Feel free to read it.
Children's first writing. Okay, so back to me. I'm sorry, that sounded more self-centered than I wanted it to. So, I'm going to be talking about The Conjuring and The Conjuring 2. Neither of the movies quite reached Poltergeist or Exorcist levels of hysteria, like nobody was killed. But they both had their own weird and unexplained incidents. So if people are unfamiliar with The Conjuring series, it follows Ed and Lorraine Warren, who are famous ghost hunters and paranormal, like, people.
Famous.
And I put famous with a question mark because there's been a lot of controversy about them. Because a lot of people are, like, split down the middle when it comes to them. Yeah. They're like, well, they invited themselves without, like, question. And it's, I can do a whole episode on Ed and Lorraine Warren and what's going on there. But for people who don't know, they were especially active, like, in the late 70s and stuff like that. And Lorraine Warren is a supposed psychic. And she used to investigate with her husband, Ed. And they are famous for having a... Ed has long since passed away. And they are famous for having a museum of haunted objects in their basement, including Annabelle the doll, who, unlike the real movie, was not a creepy porcelain doll, was instead an even creepier Raggedy Ann doll.
I hate Raggedy Ann.
We should cover dolls at one point. Am I just emojis in your phone?
No.
Oh. Okay.
Am I just emojis? No. Shelby has chickens and a unicorn because she picked that.
Oh, okay. So, first thing first is that during the filming, there was mysterious bruising that was going on. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't seen the first movie, here's a minor spoiler. The mother wakes up with weird bruises along her arms and legs. And they find out later that it's because a ghost is trying to break her down to possess her so she can kill her children. But at first, they think it's because of some sort of iron deficiency. So, The Conjuring, as I said, sees a family, like, quiet, they're called the Perrins. Family's quiet home life disturbed by malevolent spirits who want to kill the children.
Mm-hmm.
And the disruption may not have ended on set because Patrick Wilson, who played Ed Warren in both the movie and its 2016 sequel, and he was also in the Insidious series as well, has a really long horror film repertoire nowadays. Recounted that one of the child actors on The Conjuring set got mysteriously injured. So Joey King, who played Christine, ended up covered in strange bruises all over her body after just a couple weeks of shooting. Wilson explained to the UK's The Independent newspaper that King hadn't been doing any stunts. Child actors don't do stunts. Nor had anything hit her over the course of filming. They just kind of showed up. And there was a quote from him I remember that, like, he said that someone asked her about the bruising, because I guess it had gotten out, and it was someone on South, I don't remember it exactly, and I don't have it in front of me, mm-hmm. but apparently she had looked up with that person with, like, you know, that childish confusion, fear in yeah. her eyes, and she went, I don't know, and, you know, as a dad to him, that was terrifying, but also, to me, that's terrifying, because if there's just a little kid going, I don't know how I got these bruises, I'm just as scared as you are. Like, oh, that's not normal.
No.
Like, are you hitting yourself in your sleep? Because I hope that's the case. I've done that before. I'm a weird sleeper. So the marks apparently just disappeared eventually. Wilson still felt weird about using the antidote during press for that movie, even though he admitted it totally fit the bill. Wilson also confirmed over the course of the chat that his own home is haunted, noting that I've heard people on two different occasions say that they've heard kids' laughter in the middle of the night in my house, and that used to freak my wife out, but, like, that's a completely other story, but he did actually ask, I think, Lorraine Warren about that, because she's still alive, and she's like, oh, children's spirits just like to play sometimes.
No.
But it's also like, sometimes those aren't children, those are demons. They like to take the form of children. Just saying. So there was also possessed drapes. The Conjuring, like, it was a pretty famous movie and it made a lot of money. So Wan has noticed that he would be too busy directing to, like, bloop, 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 bloop. Okay, let me just Good. Start completely over.
Okay.
Yeah. The Conjuring scared up over 300 million worldwide, meaning the mastermind behind it, Wan, would be seen as the biggest target should any demonic forces feel they were being unfairly portrayed on screen. Wan has noted that he would be too busy directing to even notice a spirit standing next to him. However, Wilson, whose underlying interest in the paranormal seems to have grown exponentially while shooting the films, did show him a video while on the set of Conjuring 2 of a curtain supposedly moving by itself. At the end of the soundstage, there was these huge curtain drapes. They started swaying on their own, and they just kept moving. Now the doors were open, the air conditioning was switched off. They just moved on their own. Wan told Star 2 and Seoul So. South Korea. You're a K-pop stan. I can't pronounce those things. You can.
Seoul.
Okay, I'm a dumbass. You know this. Considering his lead actor supposedly caught the whole thing on camera, it just begs the question, where the hell is that film? And can I see it? I want to see it.
Can I see it? I mean,
Let me see your ghosts. Hey, baby.
No.
Heard you got a haunted drape set. Can I watch it wiggle around without any wind moving it?
I hated that so much.
I love you. Okay. So.
Excuse you.
I'm so sorry. I told you I was disgusting. So the guys and the kids weren't the only ones that were being targeted by spirits. Reportedly, lead actress Vera Farmiga also experienced some odd happenings over the course of filming. In an interview with Collider, Wan discussed how the actress confided to him that she had been waking up between 3 a.m. and 4 a.m. every morning from the moment they started working on The Conjuring. 3 a.m. through 4 a.m. is known as the demonic hour. It is a significant focal point of several horror movies, including The Exorcism of Emily Rose. And even weirder, The Conjuring itself features a witch who died during that specific time frame. Something that, like, the lead actress brought to Wan's attention after confiding to him. The actress continued to have trouble sleeping afterwards. And it's like, I work with all that stuff. So mm-hmm. 3 a.m. is the time of night where if you wake up suddenly, it's best if you just roll over, close your eyes, and not look up and do anything if you're open to, like, the spiritual side of things. Because something might be fucking around.
Mm.
You don't... And usually, demons and things like that come in threes to knock the Holy Ghost, the Holy Spirit, and the Holy mm-hmm. Father, the Holy Trinity, whatever. So, yeah, I don't fuck with threes, unlike the Greeks. Another thing that affected the lead actress was that during a roundtable discussion for The Conjuring, Farmiga also explained a rather spooky discovery of three digital claw marks on her computer screen. The weird part is that the marks appeared immediately after she finished speaking to the director, James Rann, about playing the role of Lorraine Warren and about her desire to have Patrick Wilson acting opposite of her. It's like, is anyone mad at her? Who did she piss off? Who did Wilson piss off? Why is it three claw marks? Who's trying to get her? Why is she waking up at 3 a.m.? So once again, our poor lead actress had spooky issues on set. So she was really being targeted.
Yeah.
Farmiga revealed that quite literally the day after she completed her work on The Conjuring, she woke up with three claw mark bruises across her thigh.
No.
Her thigh. She noted that they weren't painful, silencing those who sought to suggest she might be some under, like, a paranormal attack, and more like little bruises. The fact that the marks looked as though they'd been made by long fingernails was what really freaked her out. Apparently, she even texted the director about it, but much like her connection between the witch in the story and her own real-life sleep disruption, he wasn't too impressed. Even if they're not painful, there are three claw marks on your thighs.
Mm-hmm.
Those aren't bruises that can easily...
Yeah, especially since those three claw marks were digitally on her computer screen.
That doesn't happen. That's not normal.
I don't like.
Yeah, okay. So, spooky stuff didn't affect only those directly involved in the movie. Screenwriters Carrie and Chad Hayes recounted in a chat with The Collider that Carrie's wife had experienced something weird while he was away on set. Two, with Carrie noting, when things happen, it's usually to a wife or a woman at home whose husband is gone. She experiences more. Nightmares of the everyday housewife was just like, I don't know if that's true. Like, I'll be home by myself. I'm a single gay lad who lives with his dad, and I'll be home by myself and I'll hear shit and I'm like, all right. And my stepmom doesn't really experience stuff when my dad's not around, so I don't know if that's necessarily true. But anyway, in this case, his wife noticed weird water, like a weird water formation that appeared on the floor out of nowhere, so Dark Water-esque, if you know that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And considering that it was cement on an open floor plan, the spill was blamed on the family dog. But the poor pooch was left out the hook once the spill started showing up again and again in the same exact spot.
Wow.
So they would clean it up, and it would appear again. Clean it up, it would appear again. And the dogs over there like, I'm not peeing. It's not me. So she went to Lorraine Warren herself for professional advice, and Carrie deduced it was a water poltergeist feeding off teenage angst from one of his kids who Hayes and his wife confirmed was going through turbulent time, which, like, me too. The reminder remains remarkably calm about the incident, noting that nothing weird has happened ever to him personally. But you have to have pretty good faith in protecting yourself, because when you write about stuff like this, it can be somewhat of a beacon. And this is why we only write about horror movies instead of actually writing them. And that's a quote from the article I found funny. But it's like, bro, how angsty was your teenager? Like, damn. They out here attracting poltergeists.
Like, can you imagine being that angsty?
Like, what are they doing all day? Are they listening? Are they in their room, laying on the floor with blackout curtains, listening to Linkin Park while there's just candles all around them?
No, My Chemical Romance.
But I feel like crawling in my skin, these rooms, you cannot heal. It's like
true.
The quintessential like emo teen lyric.
Oh, fine.
Yeah, I'm right.
I used to be an emo teen too.
We all emo teens in our hearts. In our hearts.
Yeah. Look at my
room. Look at my, I know.
I have fucking blackout curtains.
I do too, but also.
But that's because I just don't like waking up in the morning.
So also the thing about like writing horror movies, attracting things is like I fucking write like a motherfucker, and I'm actually planning something right now. I don't know. I think I might make it a webcomic. I'm not sure yet. Mm-hmm. And it will be horror based. And whenever I do write, I do tend to write horror. It's my favorite genre, or dark fantasy. Those are my favorite genres to write in. And it's like, I sure to hell hope I don't attract a demon just because I'm writing about a demon. I sure as hell hope not. I don't need that in my life. Ugh. So, when the real life, here's another. There's like several, like three left after this one. So when the real-life Perrin family came to visit the set of The Conjuring, they were already on edge with how realistic everything was, with Cindy, the second eldest, now a grown woman, but a child at the time with the haunting, physically moving away after coming face-to-face with the witch. But it didn't end there. During a set visit with Shock 2 You Drop, screenwriter Chad Hayes recalled how, in the style of an actual horror movie, one of the Perrin children told him straight out, "Something really bad is going to happen here today." Rarely, their mother, Carolyn, subsequently fell and broke her hip. She was the only one who didn't make it to the set that day, which might mean it's better to face your demons head on rather than have them seek you out via a creepy child premonition. Mm. So the Warren's infamous artifact room, which I mentioned earlier, with especially Annabelle the doll, mm-hmm. was recreated for The Conjuring. And considering it's a room where paranormal investigators keep all their spookiest souvenirs, the process of making it like almost exactly mm-hmm. for the movie could be seen as a tempting fate, depending on like your superstitions. Mm-hmm. But during the same visit as the Perrin family, producer Rob Cohen detailed how on the purpose built set of the Warren's infamous room, there was one particular piece of their history that just wouldn't stay still. A wooden pig, supposedly, kept moving around the room. It would be there, and it'll come back, and it would move over to there, Cohen explained. So it's like little piggy going off to the market on his own. I just have two more. And in keeping with being the less scary of the two films, The Conjuring 2 only really had a couple of like low-mileage spook incidents to speak of, which were discussed in detail, but in a set visit report conducted by Shock. So, the set, first of all, was blessed by a priest prior to the shooting take place. Mm-hmm. It's seriously haunted, at least according to Warner Bros. Security guard Johnny Matuk, who doubles as a real-life ghost hunter. But that didn't stop drilling and hammering underneath the stage when there was no one working there. So, that haunting doesn't have to do with the movie itself. It more has to do with the set, which I think is really amusing. It's also revealed that in that set report, Lee Wano, Juan Van's longtime friend and filmmaking buddy, had a strange incident while visiting the set himself. According to the reports, a load of Insidious photos, which Wano had shot during his production on the movie, mysteriously showed up on his iPad while he was visiting his buddy. However, they were not saved on his PC or his iPad, and he couldn't get rid of them either. Unsurprising, really, if the set was really haunted as a claim, just to be on the safe side, like, maybe stop making Conjuring movies. Maybe make another Paddington movie. I love that little
punk. I love Paddington.
He's so cute. But yeah, so that's the hauntings of The Conjuring.
Alrighty, so this next one actually kind of has to do with a couple movies. Specifically, Lovecraft and Evil Dead.
Oh, that racist asshole.
So, and the history of it with...
Created a good-ass genre, though.
The Necromicon.
Oh, I heard about that. I was looking at it, but I didn't read that much.
So, With the Evil Dead remake on the way, this was written in 2013.
I love the Evil Dead remake, by the way.
Yes. So, Ryan looks back over the unholy history of its forbidden volume, the Necromon. I mean, the Necromicon. Necromicon. When a book comes wrapped in black plastic and barbed wire, it's probably a sign that its contents aren't safe to read.
Oh, for sure.
Unfortunately, the cast of Fade of Red's Evil Dead remake are cursed with more curiosity than sense, and thus another group of young innocents falls victim to the dreaded Necromon, a mythical book of demonic power. Legend has it that the Necromicon, I'm going to call it the Necromon because I don't want to say anything longer. The Necromon.
You could just call it Necro.
Necro.
Necrophilia.
Sure. We'll call it Necro.
We need to do an episode on necrophilia.
I don't want to.
It's so weird, though.
I know, and I don't want to.
Okay.
So, the Necro is what we'll call it. Was penned by a mad Arabian poet named Abdul Arazed after a decade spent roaming the ruined cities of Babylon and Memphis. Having completed what he calls the Al-Azvif, Abdul descends further into insanity before either disappearing or being devoured by an invisible monster, depending on whose account you believe.
Sorry.
Therefore, after this unholy... Oh, wait.
Yeah, that might be best.
Okay.
Do you have a garbage can?
Yes. The white one right there. Thereafter, this unholy manuscript was translated into Greek by scholars in the 10th century, burned in the Middle Ages, before the last few remaining copies disappeared into dusty libraries, only to be discovered by the modern age in the modern age by an ill-starred few. Actually, the Necro has a much shorter history than its true creator, H.P. Lovecraft, had his readers to believe. Although inspired by real texts such as the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Necro was a product of Lovecraft's fertile imagination, and mention of its first appeared in the short story The Hound, first published in 1924. The tale told of two grave robbers doomed by their theft of a jade amulet, which they recognized as the thing hinted in the thing hinted of in the forbidden necro of the mad Arab Abdul. Lovecraft was apparently unhappy with The Hound, but both it and The Nameless City, published in 1921, marked the beginning of the author's endeavors to set his story in one coherent universe. This Cthulhu mythos, as it later became known, suggests that an ancient godlike being once ruled the earth, and it could return to either destroy us or drive us all insane by anyone foolish enough to reawaken them. The Necro tied directly to this mythos, since it was said to contain a lengthy account of extraterrestrial old ones, and to merely look upon its pages would be enough to inspire madness. This attempt to build a coherent world with its own histories, deities, and forbidden texts gave Lovecraft's work a wonderful sense of the unknown, providing sci-fi and horror literature with kind of rich storytelling Tolkien would later bring to his Middle-earth books. The Necro and its related mythology also inspired a number of writers in Lovecraft's circle, and its name is mentioned in the works of such authors as Auguste Derleth, who tinkered greatly with the Cthulhu mythos in his stories, and Clark Ashton Smith. And what became a lively exchange of ideas, this little coterie of storytellers constantly embroidered on Lovecraft's myths and their own tales. Smith came up with the Book of Ebon for his stories, which Lovecraft readily mentioned in his own work. Robert Bloch, who would later write Psycho, came up with De Vermis Mysteries, a book whose pages are potent enough to summon forth demonic beings from another dimension. This too was worked into Lovecraft stories, including The Haunter of the Dark and The Shadow Out of Time. Lovecraft often talked about the Necro in his letters, which rambled on about everything from his Roman history to literature to his incurable sweet tooth, where he suggested that his inspiration for the book came from Gothic writing, which often featured ancient text and forbidden literature. It is certainly easy to draw a line between Victorian Gothic writings and of Edgar Allan Poe, whom Lovecraft was an open admirer, and the Necro. Poe would go to great lengths to convince his readers that his tales were genuine, and his 1844 story, The Balloon Hoax, was initially published as genuine news story in New York's The Sun newspaper. Although Lovecraft was never quite that mischievous, his constant references to both real works of academia and non-existent books, like the Necron, help him to blur the lines between fiction and reality, just as a found footage movie would do in modern horror cinema. So it's a very thin line they're walking.
So it's like, it doesn't exist, but like...
It might.
It kind of does.
Yeah, so it's one of those, it's like a fake book within a real book.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I want to see if I can find a fake copy of it.
Oh, it's because they're not the original.
I just want to collect weird books. Is that it?
No.
There's more.
When Lovecraft...
But wait,
died in 1937, he was still largely unknown except to the devoted readers of the Pulp Fiction magazines, which published his stories. It was only in the decades after his death that his fiction was published into book form, and thus became more widely read. And as Lovecraft's fame grew, so did the strange influence of the Necro. Numerous authors, including such famous names as Neil Gaiman...
Hey! He's my favorite author.
Stephen King have championed Lovecraft's stories and written elements of his myths into their own tales. The Swiss artist H.R. Geiger was also so taken by Lovecraft that he called a 1977 collection of his erotic occult art the Necron.
Excuse me? Erotic occult art?
Yeah.
Boy.
This book, and in particular the illustration titled Necronom 4, would lead...
I need to look that
Geiger
up.
...designing the Star Beast for Ridley Scott out... for Ridley Scott's Alien.
Oh my god, I definitely need to look it up now.
Sam Raimi's horror classic, The Evil Dead, was clearly influenced by Lovecraft's work, although the author would probably would have balked at the fact of... Whoa. I don't... Oh my god.
Y'all, I looked up the... I looked at Necromon 4, and now we're just looking at horrific aliens fucking.
Oh, God. Okay.
It's awful. I love it at the same time, but it's terrible.
The Evil Dead in 1981 was clearly influenced by Lovecraft's work, although the author probably would have balked at the thought of writing about five teenagers in a woodland cabin. His stories more commonly revolved around scientists or other educated types. The tape recording of a long dead professor is a first person narrative straight out of Lovecraft's tale. According to The Evil Dead, the Necron was bound in human skin, its pages written in human blood. Lovecraft always danced around the specifics of the Necron's appearance, but the fact that it could be found on the shelves of a British museum or the fictional Mistonic University, it's fictional, I can mispronounce it, and Arkham suggests that Lovecraft probably didn't have roughly stitched human dermis in mind. Nevertheless, the tome in The Evil Dead behaves in a singularity Lovecraftian manner with the recital of its text summing forth the ancient horror. The Necro, or designer Tom Sullivan's version of it, was kept a key plot in the point of the Evil Dead films, with the first film even being called the Book of the Dead at one point. The Volume makes an extended appearances in the third film, Army of Darkness, where it takes it on a mischievous life of its own. The book returns, of course, in this year's Evil Dead remake, its pages filled with hideous engravings and hurriedly etched obscenities. So, in general, this book is one of those things that is not, like, has a world of its own, and it's not really 100% sure if it is real or if it's not. And as Abdul wrote himself, that is not the dead which can eternal lie. So if you don't know the story of the original Necron without, like, Lovecraft's whole writing of it, it's about necromancy. It's about raising the dead and summoning demons. It's not a good. It's very, very creepy. It's said to be, like, it's said to drive people insane. And that if it were ever to truly be used for its intended purpose of necromancy, that the world might end. So that's a fun.
That's a fun indeed. I also wanted to share this news article, not related to anything we just talked about. But I think it would be fun for one of us to find a spooky news article to read every episode.
Oh.
So I'll go this time.
Okay, because you didn't tell me about that.
Yeah, I just spontaneously did it because I saw it today and I was like, that's a good idea. Okay. So this is on mirror.co.uk, so it is a valid news source. Gateway to Hell discovered in cave with hundreds of anti-witch marks lining the walls. And it was literally uploaded today, February 15th, 2019. Shut up. So, an unprecedented number of anti-witch marks have been found in caves at Limestone Gorge in the Midlands, experts have said. The marks are said to prevent evil spirits rising from the underworld, and there are hundreds of them carved on the caves and ceilings of the caves at Cresswell Crags, on the border between Nottinghamshire and Derbyshire. It's thought to be the largest collection of its kind in one place in the UK. Witches' marks, or apotropaic marks, from the Greek word apotropion, to turn away, are most commonly found in historic churches and houses near doorways, windows, and fireplaces to protect the inhabitants from evil spirits. The discovery at Cresswell Crags was made by enthusiast Haley Clark and Ed Waters from the Subterranean Britannica group during a cave tour, where they noticed the rare protection marks on the walls. Experts said the number and variety of the marks found in the caves is unprecedented. And there's a picture of them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The marks were previously thought to have been graffiti from the time before the caves were shut off. Among the most common are the double V engravings thought to reference Mary, Virgin of Virgins, NPM, or Pace Maria, while other symbols are believed to be devices for capturing or trapping evil, including diagonal lines, boxes, and mazes. The marks appear to have been added to over time and may indicate a need to strengthen the protection against underworld spirits in response to unexpected sickness, death, or poor crops, the experts say. Until now, the largest known quantity of witches' marks in caves in Britain was 57 in Somerset, but the number at Cresswell Crags is far higher, with hundreds in one cave alone, and marks now found in all the caves at the site. And look at that. There's the double V, and there's the PM.
Oh, wow.
So they really carved in deep.
Yeah, like, that's not a light, like, little... Mm-hmm.
There may even have been more in the past, as the caves were excavated by archaeologists during the 19th century and were widened in the process, potentially accounting for some surfaces featuring no marks. It is the latest significant discovery at the caves, which provided shelter for Neanderthal and anatomically modern people through a crucial period of human evolution between 130,000 and 10,000 years ago. The site has been a rich source of archaeological finds and even features Britain's earliest cave art, with, like, pictures of birds, deer, bisons, and horses. So John Charlesworth, heritage facilitator and the tour leader at the time of discovery of the protective marks, said, "These witches' marks were in plain sight all the time. Being present at the moment their true significance was revealed will stay with me forever. This remarkable place continues to give up its secrets. Academic and TV presenter Professor Ronald Hutton, an authority on folklore, so I need to look him up. This discovery is significant because it looks like the largest assemblage of protective marks ever found in British caves, and possibly anywhere in Britain. This is a large new area of research for historians and archaeologists, and so adds appreciatively to the importance of the crags as a world resource. The team who look after Cresswell Crags are now working with academics and experts from the historic England to better understand the significance and the extent of the discovery at the site, which is a scheduled monument. Duncan Wilson, chief executive of Historic England, said Cresswell Crags is already an international importance for its Ice Age arts and its ancient remains. To find this huge number of protection marks from the more recent past adds a whole near layer of discovery. Even 200 years ago, the English countryside was a very different place. Death and disease were everyday companions, and evil forces could readily be imagined in the dark. We can only speculate on what it was the people of Cresswell feared might emerge from the underworld into these caves. So, Cresswell Crags will be launching tours of the areas containing the witches' marks for the first time from late February.
Sorry, I showed her a cute picture of my doggy.
Yeah, it was a cute picture.
Dog.
So, yeah, those are the witches' marks caves.
Oh, gee.
It's a fun little thing I felt like I should read on here. Oh, so I did a thing, as you know.
You did do a thing.
I designed a sticker. As soon as I'm able to, I will upload it to our Instagram. I currently have it posted on my art Instagram, which is Electric Purity on, you know, Instagram. We were thinking of maybe just having it limited time until, unless more people want it than what we expected. Mm-hmm. Mainly because I saw the sticker deal that was like a packet of stickers for $10.
Yeah.
And we're broke teenagers.
Hi.
So we might do that.
And if you, like, want more stickers of, like, I don't know if we have any, like, really funny quotes or anything that we would want to, like, turn into stickers. Who knows? I might try to design some stickers, too. I'm not as good as he is, but I might try.
Yeah. So if you guys, if you guys want those, just let us know. And do you have anything else to say?
No.
No?
No.
Okay, well, guess that's it. This has been
as long as it's spooky.
And well, we'll see you next week.